From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And a major victory today at the U.S. Supreme Court for gay and transgender civil rights. The court ruling that firing someone for sexual orientation or gender identity violates federal law.
It was a 6-3 decision, and Justice Neil Gorsuch, nominated by President Trump, wrote the majority opinion arguing that an individual's homosexuality or transgender status is not relevant to employment decisions. Joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, this decision involves a number of separate cases concerning the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It applies to both sexual orientation and gender identity. How big of a deal is this, and what did the court decide exactly?
It's a huge deal, Jeremy. I think this will go down as a really landmark gay rights case. And I think that for about half the states that did not afford civil rights protections to transgender and gay workers, this is an insurance policy that they cannot be fired. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act from 1964 had barred discrimination, quote, because of sex. Now that sweeps in gay and transgender workers for the first time, even though the language doesn't explicitly say that and Congress never explicitly said it. Now they're protected.
Now, we mentioned that Justice Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion. He was joined by Chief Justice John Roberts, as well as all of the liberals on the court. It's interesting that this was a 6-3 decision when the same-sex marriage decision 5 years ago was a 5-4 decision, different court. But still, was it a surprise that there was this lineup on the court in this case?
I think Gorsuch was a little bit less of a surprise. If you listen to oral arguments, he seemed to have a lot of solicitude for the arguments that were being advanced. Although, again, I think he's held himself out as a strict textualist. So it's a little confusing that he's kind of jumped over to this language of, even though the drafters didn't say it, we kind of think they meant it. I think you're quite right. John Roberts was a huge surprise. He dissented in Obergefell, the gay marriage case. So the fact that he has jumped over to join Gorsuch and the liberals shows that something has really profoundly changed. For him.
We spoke with the LGBT civil rights organization CEO, Lambda Legal CEO today, who said this is a bigger deal than Obergefell Hodges because while not every gay couple is going to get married, they all need a job. And so this really does affect a lot of people. What about the dissent here, Dahlia? What was the reasoning for the dissent by the conservative justices, Thomas Alito, who was the third one that was on that
Brett Kavanaugh. But anyway,
Kavanaugh, of course, right. Brett Kavanaugh. What was the reasoning there?
There were two separate dissents, Jeremy. Justice Alito wrote for himself and Clarence Thomas. He had a 54-page dissent, and he essentially just said, quote, there is only one word for what the court has done today, legislation. He made the argument that the court was inventing new law and kind of imposing it onto the existing language of the Civil Rights Act. He also tacked on an appendix featuring 11 pages of dictionary definitions of the word, quote, sex. Kavanaugh wrote a gentler version of that dissent. He conceded that the policy arguments to protect gay and transgender workers under Title VII were, quote, weighty, but then he went on to say, quote, we are judges, not members of Congress, essentially saying Congress needed to change this, not us.
I want to ask you about something else the court did today. It declined to look at the issue of qualified immunity, a legal doctrine that's used to shield police from lawsuits, also a very big topic right now on Capitol Hill. What did the court say today about that?
Yeah, this is a decades-old line of cases that protects police officers and other government officials from any personal liability unless they violate what's called a, quote, clearly established right. That's such a high standard, Jeremy. It's almost never met. I think there was a hope that in light of what we've seen in recent weeks with George Floyd and other acts of police abuse, that the court might be willing to revisit that. Today, the court made clear that even though Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg have suggested it's time to revisit it, it's not happening today.
Okay, and just briefly, what is still left in the pipeline from the Supreme Court over the coming weeks?
Oh, all the big stuff. We've got DACA, which was rescinded, which will affect Dreamers across the country. We've got the June medical abortion challenge that questions whether whole women's health is still good law. We've got the Trump financial records monster blockbuster cases to come. All of that and more in the coming weeks.
And we will be following it along with you, Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now let's go to Atlanta, where the family of Rayshard Brooks spoke emotionally today about the death of their loved one at the hands of a white police officer Friday night. Here is his niece, Chastity Evans.
Me and my uncle are both 27 years of age. 27 years of age. No one walking this green earth expects to be shot and killed like trash in the street for falling asleep in a drive-thru.
Rayshard Brooks, who is black, was approached by two white officers outside of a Wendy's in Atlanta. He'd been drinking and was asleep in his car, which was parked in the Wendy's drive-thru. A several-minute taped peaceful encounter showed him complying with police. He told him his sister lived nearby. Critics say if he were white, the officers might have told him to go there or call a relative. They handcuffed him. He grabbed one officer's taser and ran, appearing to fire back at the pursuing officer, who shot him twice in the back, killing him. WABE reporter Stephanie Stokes is here. And Stephanie, shortly after that shooting Friday night, Atlanta's white police chief resigned. Yesterday, Officer Garrett Rolfe, who shot Brooks, was fired. The other officer on the scene, Devin Brosnan, is on administrative leave. You know, now some would say if someone grabs a taser and runs, why isn't that considered dangerous? But do we know exactly why Officer Rolfe was fired?
Well, I can say that less than 24 hours after this shooting, the mayor held a press conference. And this was before the public had the full dash cam, body cam footage. And we were just seeing this very shaky cell phone video showing the struggle that led to the Rayshard Brooks running and the officers shooting after him. Even at that point, the mayor said in her press conference that she did not believe that the officer acted correctly. She thought it was excessive force, and she called for him to be fired. Since then, we have heard in interviews from police chiefs around the country that there were options that the officers could have considered. Perhaps they could have set up a perimeter around the area once Rayshard Brooks had taken off, or, you know, they had his car and his keys, so they knew who he was. So they could have done something different potentially. And also, yeah, it's, as you mentioned, it's important to point out that this encounter didn't start with a struggle. There was more than a half hour of time from when the officers approached him and this arrest started to take place when there was this struggle over the taser. So in this half hour, the interaction was cordial, and Rayshard Brooks was at times contradicting himself, but he was calm overall.
Yeah. Well, and not only, as you said, are police chiefs like former L.A. Chief Charles Ramsey saying they had his license, they knew where he lived and his name, they could have let him go and then gone and gotten him. Also, you know, to use deadly force, you have to feel your life is threatened, and it's going to be tough for them to say a taser is deadly force, because they don't say that when it is used by police on suspects. So tough now to say it when they lose control of it. How are people in the area there reacting? There was a rally set for today that was originally set to protest Georgia's really failed primary voting. But what are people there now saying about this shooting?
Well, you know, Atlanta, like other cities around the country, has seen 2 weeks of demonstrations, largely sparked by the death of George Floyd. So people have been out in the streets already. We've seen thousands of people here protesting. And so this local shooting has really reignited that movement and made it, really localized it for people. I was outside of the Wendy's on Saturday, and what I saw was tense. The police had blocked off the roads leading to the intersection nearby. So it was just protesters in the intersection. But it was mostly peaceful. People were exhausted. They were grieving. And I think they wanted the city to know that it's not different in Atlanta. Atlanta likes to say that it's the city too busy to hate, that it's the birthplace of the civil rights movement because Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was born here, that people of all races get along here. But I think what I was hearing from protesters is that's not true. These police killings of unarmed black men, black people are still happening here and they need to be addressed.
Yeah, we should point out that the night after the shooting, protesters set the Wendy's where Rayshard Brooks died on fire. Atlanta police now searching for the person responsible for that. They believe it to be a white woman. WABE reporter Stephanie Stokes, thank you so much. We'll continue to follow the aftermath of the shooting of Rayshard Brooks. Thank you.
Thank you.
So much going on right now. Let's bring in someone who's had experience at the very highest levels of government, director of the CIA and later Secretary of Defense under former President Obama. And before that, he was White House Chief of Staff to President Bill Clinton. And before that, a Democratic congressman from California. Leon Panetta, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Well, and there's so much going on right now, from the pandemic to the nationwide protests on police violence and racism to the economic situation. I want to just first start by asking you, what has stood out most to you in this moment over the last several weeks?
I think with all of these crises, it's not just COVID-19, it's not just racial injustice. I also think there's a crisis of leadership from Washington. It kind of tells me that the basic strength of this country really does lie in the American people. It's the American people who, in many ways, have taken on the responsibility of dealing with the COVID virus, dealing with racial injustice. These protests are, I think, the voice of the American people speaking out on racial injustice. And I think in many ways our forefathers were right that in the end it's we the people that really do make a difference in terms of the future of our country. And that, I think, has been reassuring over these last few weeks.
Well, when it comes to the issue of leadership, we saw this extraordinary thing over the last month, a number of senior military officials breaking ranks to criticize President Trump's calls for using the military to suppress protests. Retired General James Mattis, who was President Trump's Secretary of Defense, said he was appalled by Trump's reaction to the protests, and he described the president as a threat to the Constitution. And then last week, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, publicly apologized for taking part in President Trump's photo op in Washington, where authorities forcibly removed peaceful protesters from Lafayette Square. Here's Mark Milley speaking.
I should not have been there. My presence in that moment and in that environment created a perception of the military involved in domestic politics. As a commissioned, uniformed officer, it was a mistake that I have learned from, and I sincerely hope we all can learn from it.
What do you make of that, and do you expect more military leaders to come out and distance themselves from the president?
Well, I have tremendous respect for our military leadership, and I give them great credit for stepping forward. Their fundamental loyalty is not to the president, but to the country. And I think for that reason, they felt compelled to speak out when they sensed that the president was moving towards trying to make the military a political arm of the White House, as opposed to a force that is responsible for protecting this country. And so I really do think that the American people and these military officers who have tremendous love for their country had the courage to stand up and speak out. And I think it was at an important moment. I mean, these kids are trained to fight foreign adversaries. They're not trained to fight our own people.
Leon Panetta, I'm sure you saw this after James Mattis's public criticism of President Trump. John Dowd, a former attorney for the president, criticized Mattis in an open letter saying Mattis let a bunch of hack politicians use his good name and reputation. And he told him to bone up on his homework and stop listening to Uncle Leon, which apparently was a reference to you. Was it a reference to you? And what did you think when you saw that?
I have no idea whether it was a reference to me or not. If it was a reference to me, then I take it with great pride, because I think it is important for people like Jim Mattis and the other military leaders to speak out when they feel that a line has been crossed in terms of responsibility to our U.S. forces.
I want to ask you about what's going on in Seattle. Protesters there have taken over a portion of that city's Capitol Hill neighborhood, forcing police to evacuate a precinct there. Republicans have been using this to say Democrats are in favor of lawlessness because both the mayor and the governor there who are allowing this are Democrats. President Trump has referred to it as an anarchist takeover and called the people there terrorists. What do you think about this autonomous zone in Seattle?
Well, every mayor, every governor is going to have to address these issues within their own realm of responsibility, because it's not likely that that the president is going to provide very much leadership here. But I do think we have to recognize that this country really is at a turning point. To have this large number of protests across the country, I mean, the reality is that a majority of the American people support the fact that we have to address racism. I think the number went up from something like 51% in January to now almost 76% of the public that supports that. So obviously, it's up to the local communities to try to ensure that these protests are peaceful and that they don't violate the rights of others. And I think that's going to be the responsibility of the Seattle officials, not Washington.
What do you think should come out of this movement that has been going on across the country? Will there be something as significant as the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act from the 1960s?
You know, in my 50 years of public life, actually, one part of my career, I was director of the Office for Civil Rights and was responsible for enforcing equal education laws, particularly in the South. So I have a deep feeling about the importance of trying to deliver on the promise of this country that we're all created equal. Now the killing of George Floyd, which was almost in essence a public lynching that the whole country saw. I don't think this is just another incident. I think this is a turning point. And when you have not just Democrats, but Republicans talking about the importance of reforms, to get rid of the chokehold, get rid of no-knock warrants, to improve training, to address some of these other causes of housing and jobs and poverty that are part of the problem, I really do have a great deal of confidence that if both sides are talking about the problem, that there is a good chance that we'll enact some of these important reforms.
We are also, of course, just 4.5 months or so away from the election, and we just saw in Georgia technical issues with the state's new voting machines and confusion over COVID-19 restrictions that contributed to people having to wait hours to vote. I think no matter what happens, it's pretty clear that coronavirus will still be with us in some form come November. Are you worried at this point about the national elections taking place in November safely, securely, and fairly?
It's really important, based on what's happening in our country with the COVID virus, with these concerns about racial injustice, with the concerns about whether our democracy can respond to these challenges, that it's critical that we proceed with this election in November. And I think steps need to be taken by the Congress, by the administration, by governors, by local communities, to ensure that everyone is able to exercise the right to vote. That is the ultimate power in our democracy, is the ability of the people to vote. So, yeah, I'm concerned about some of the things you see when you see what happened in Georgia, when you see the governors and even the president talking about the fact that mail-in ballots somehow are fraudulent when they're not. There's no evidence to that effect. It raises concerns because the people ought to have the ability to vote any way they want. That's the most incredible right we have in our democracy. And I think we have to do everything necessary to ensure that they can exercise that right in November.
I want to ask you about one more thing. And, you know, this is the kind of story that in another world, it might be the start of our show. Today, it's like, you know, page 25 in the newspaper because there are just so many other things going on. And that is that the U.S. Navy has deployed three of its seven active aircraft carriers in the Pacific. That is the biggest deployment of U.S. aircraft carriers in the Pacific since 2017. China has criticized the move. What do you make of that, and are you concerned about the rising tensions right now between the United States and China and whether they could turn into military tensions in a way that they haven't so far?
Well, we've talked about a lot of the domestic crises that the country's facing, and at the same time, there are a number of dangerous flashpoints in the world. And I think it is very important that we have to make clear to China that they cannot take advantage of this moment, because I think right now they view the United States as weakened by the COVID-19 virus and other problems, and that they can take advantage of it. And they are trying to take advantage of it throughout the world, trying to reassert their leadership and their economic strength. And in the South China Sea, they continue to extend their influence. Obviously, they've taken steps to try to take over Hong Kong. There's concerns that they might do the same thing with Taiwan. I think we have to reassert our strength in the Pacific. I think it is important to have our carriers there, if nothing else, to send China a signal that they are not going to have a free rein in that part of the world to do whatever they want.
That is former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, also former White House Chief of Staff and former CIA Director. Leon Panetta, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is calling for the immediate release of American businessman Paul Whelan, sentenced in a Russian court earlier today to 16 years in prison for spying. Whelan was arrested in Moscow in December of 2018. He claims he was set up. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford is on Skype from Moscow. So, Sarah, who does Paul Whelan say he is?
He says he is a tourist, a man who's had a long interest in Russia, who has a lot of friends here, who's been traveling here since 2006, 2007. And he says on the occasion when he was arrested, he was here for the wedding of a friend, another former U.S. Marine, an American, who was here in Moscow to marry a Russian woman. Mr. Whelan came for the wedding. And as he was getting prepared in the evening for that wedding, FSB security officers burst into his room and arrested him. And they say they caught him with a USB flash drive on his person, which contained Russian state secrets. Now, he says he was set up. He says he was framed by a man who'd been a friend for some 10 years, but who was a Russian security agent. So it's a very complex and murky story, as all espionage cases are. And in this case, because it's Russia, the trial itself has been closed, so we haven't been able to see any of the actual evidence. None of it has ever been made public.
Right, it's all conducted behind closed doors, but do we know anything? He has complained in the past about his condition in prison awaiting this verdict. Did he have a lawyer?
He had a court-appointed lawyer, appointed right at the very beginning, we believe, by the FSB. His family didn't change the lawyer because it's extremely expensive. And like Paul Whelan, they believe that the outcome of this trial was preordained, so it made no point as far as they were it made no difference as far as they were concerned. We've been following the trial right from the very beginning, and we have been able to go to custody hearings every 2 or 3 months. And we have heard something from Mr. Whelan. We've been able to shout questions to him in the cage in court, as I was able to do again today. And all along, he has insisted that he's innocent, that this is a setup, that he's a political hostage. Now, there has been a lot of suspicion that this case is part of a much bigger political game for Moscow. And indeed, today we've already heard from the Deputy Foreign Minister here talk about a potential prisoner swap and talk about, in fact, some high-profile Russian prisoners in the United States who Russia wants to see home and has wanted to see home for a long time. And so perhaps that's where this is moving now. It's certainly moving now, I think, from talk of espionage to talk of politics.
So he may be a bargaining chip. Just briefly, how does he look?
He looks well, although he has just had emergency surgery on a strangulated hernia. It's something he'd complained about repeatedly in court. We'd heard him talk about it in the past. In fact, at one court hearing in the past, an ambulance was called. He got very sick not so long ago and was rushed to hospital and had emergency surgery. For all that, he looked okay. He was quite cheerful. He was saying it was his dog's birthday today, but he was also saying that this is a sham trial and that the charges against him are ridiculous. So I just spoke to his brother, in fact, who's in Canada, and his brother was saying it's like a gut punch hearing your twin brother sentenced to 16 years in a high-security Russian prison. But he said now the entire family was focused on trying to pressure the politicians to talk about this case and to find a political resolution. But I think that's going to be complicated. It's not going to happen soon.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
So as every single state in the country eases coronavirus restrictions, do you have questions about what the heck you're supposed to do? Especially since there are about 21,000 new cases a day, about the same as a month ago. 23 states are now seeing rises in COVID cases compared to 20 with declining numbers. And in Texas, for instance, hospitalizations are spiking, but restaurants increased capacity to 75% on Friday. Masks aren't required in public places. And malls were described as packed this weekend. In other states, health officials have been fired, they say, because of their warnings. So, again, what are we supposed to do? Well, turn to Professor Bromage, of course. Aaron Bromage, a biologist at University of Massachusetts Dartmouth. He writes a wildly popular blog about risk. Professor Aaron, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
So if people, you know, want to do their own sleuthing, and I know friends who say, well, why don't I just check stats? How do they do that? What kind of data do you look at?
Well, that's the hard thing. The data at the moment is so murky from so many different states. Case counts are not always perfect. The one that I turn to the most is looking at number of hospitalizations, but also how many tests that they run and how many of those become positive or are positive. If that number starts to rise and the trends start coming up, then we really need to be taking measures to slow things down.
Yeah, you mean on your own, like stay home more or, you know, make sure you're socially distanced. But can we assume those state figures are correct? Because in Florida, Ohio, Colorado, to name just a few, state employees have been fired or forced to resign. They say for publishing data that conflicted with the state's rosier assessment. Florida data scientist Rebecca Jones now publishes her own dashboard, which she says better reflects the state's COVID data than the state's does. So who do we trust?
Yeah, and that's the problem. That's one of the things that really frustrates me right now is certain states are, for want of a better word, goosing the data to tell a different narrative, a narrative that they want to tell rather than what is actually happening on the ground. You know, not counting people that are actually infected with COVID and dying, but then counting a test where somebody's getting two or three tests to show that they're now negative as new tests. So it sort of counts three times as being a negative rather than once as a positive. It is getting quite difficult to work out what's going on. One of the things that's hard to manipulate, though, is those hospitalizations. Unfortunately, they're about 2 to 3 weeks behind what's actually happening in the community. But if we see hospitalizations starting to rise, then it's almost too late at that stage.
Okay. So keep an eye on those things. But let's just go to the micro here, because you talk very specifically, Professor Bromage, about, you know, things that people can do. I heard you say the other day, when it comes to haircuts, for instance, your family, you had the hairdresser come to your deck, your back deck, and do the whole family?
We actually went to her house, and she set up out in her driveway, and all four of us from my family went and had haircuts. Basically, because my house has been very good on isolating, we didn't represent four times the risk to the hairdresser, because we're just one pod. And so we went there and had all our hair cut at the one time, outdoors, wearing masks. You know, there was a risk involved, but we understood the risk, and we reduced the harm as much as possible by, you know, the way in which we conducted the haircuts.
Well, but see, so there are people, I'm sure, in some parts of the country, and in fact, you're based in Massachusetts, people in Massachusetts who are saying, well, wait a second, what's wrong with going to the barber? What's wrong with going to the hair salon?
Yeah, and I've seen some local barbers and hair salons that are actually doing a marvelous job with their, you know, risk reduction inside their businesses. Basically, having fewer people in there, not taking long appointments, not having people waiting, everybody wearing masks, doors wide open. There are some that are doing it really, really well, and I very much applaud them for taking those steps. There is always going to be a risk with such close contact, but we can take the risk and we can halve it or quarter it just by taking a few simple steps like mask use and reducing the numbers of people.
Yeah, and let's talk about human contact. And by the way, some of this may not be for all ears. I should probably say that. But start with hugging, because did I also hear you say we can hug now?
Yeah, and so it comes with a risk, and there's absolutely no doubt about this. But when you think about a, you know, 6-year-old child hugging their, you know, grandparent that may not be in a high risk category, you initially think of the risks that's there, but then you think about where they're hugging. They're hugging their waist, faces 2-3 feet apart, and just wash hands after that. And the risk in doing that is very quite low. When you're talking about people of the same size, you know, now your faces are at the same heights. There is certainly a risk involved, but when you hug and hug properly, your faces are facing different directions. You know, you don't want to turn and give them a kiss on the cheek and therefore blow air towards their face. But you can do it in a way that is safe as long, or safer as long as the people involved don't have high risk for severe disease.
It sounds like you're almost going to make air kissing fashionable for everyone, you know, kind of turning your face away from somebody and kissing the air away from them. But let's cut right to the chase and ask the question the CDC has not addressed, although the New York Public Health Department has, and that is intimate relations, sex. I mean, New York is saying if you're having your first, you know, a couple who's been getting to know each other, sadly, in the middle of a pandemic, you know, and have been wondering how much further to take that relationship, New York says, go ahead, but wear a mask, have only one partner, and again, avoid the face-to-face contact. Well, you know, some people might say, okay, there are people who might think masks, that could be fun. But do you think that this is safe? And do you think it's practical? I don't know. Are you hearing people doing that? You know, having, you know, talk about safe sex. I mean, having safe pandemic sex.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one, and it was quite interesting seeing that some of the posts that I wrote were being talked about quite frequently in sex industry circles about how they could actually continue operations. And I was just like, oh, I was not expecting my post to go there. but I mean, I think it would be sad to say that intimate relationships can't happen. And, you know, if you've got to meet somebody, and I think the really important thing here is the single partner, the risk that you both share will be shared just between you and your households if you have households. And I think that as long as in your daily lives you are being responsible with the interactions that you have, then I would actually go against the New York public health side of things and say, if you want to use masks, great, but there's a certain intimacy that comes with kissing and you know, being physical with somebody that you don't want to be missing out on.
Right.
I think it really comes down to the risk that you have in your daily life, and then the risks, like if you're going home to a multi-generational home, then you really need to think about what you're about to do. Whereas if you are two young single people living in apartments alone, then if that's your social circle, then I think have at it.
I got to get one last in here very quickly. We're going to talk about daycare tomorrow. But in the minute that we have, what about this idea of people expanding their family bubbles? So three or four families commit to being very safe, but taking care of each other's kids, you know, they sort of expand their family to include three.
Yeah. So it just depends on risk in the household. So if everyone's taking more risks than others, then you don't want to be expanding it. But if you all accept the risk and you are all protecting each other's back, as long as community transmissions are low, you know you can get them together relatively safely.
Yeah.
I think that finding those social pods, be it for daycare, be it for socializing, is really important for quarantine adherence so that we can actually do this longer term.
Professor Aaron Bromage of UMass at Dartmouth will link you to his incredibly popular blog about risk of hearing on that. Professor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senate Republicans plan to unveil a bill on police reform this week after Democrats unveiled their plan last week. Neither party appears ready to embrace the calls by some activists to defund the police altogether, but our next guest says unbundling the police may be a better option. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, what would it mean to unbundle the police, and where did that idea come from?
Well, the idea I kind of saw percolating among some researchers of criminal justice, among academia and some people who are ex-cops, and they make a pretty simple and I think powerful point that most people might imagine that police work essentially resembles that which they see on cop shows. And it turns out that when you look at the numbers, police spend the vast majority of their time driving around, answering radio calls, checking up on people that might be dealing with mental health issues, being frontline workers for the homeless, being essentially guardians of civic order in a way that has very little to do with violent crimes. I thought about this and thought, you know, if the police are spending the vast majority of their time dealing with problems in society that aren't related to their training as armed police, then perhaps the solution here isn't just to defund them, it's to unbundle this entanglement of police services and have specialists address each element of this bundle, whether it's mental health, homelessness, or something else.
Well, and let's talk about one area, which is traffic enforcement, traffic patrollers. I heard somebody make the case over the weekend that, well, why do we have the police stop you if you're speeding? Couldn't they just take your information down and send a note to your house saying, here's your ticket? Why does there even have to be an interaction in that situation? You point out that traffic patrollers could be the ones who do the traffic patrolling instead of an armed police officer.
Yeah, and this again just goes to a purely mathematical look at what is it that police do. So every year there's about 50 million Americans that come into contact with the police at least once. About half of those involve cars. Either people are pulled over in a car, people are in a car that's pulled over, people are involved in a traffic accident, or people call the police because they see a traffic accident or they see some traffic violation. It's not remotely obvious to me why this needs an armed response. There's lots of, as you say, times when people might have a busted taillight. I don't want those moments to escalate and become violent, but we've seen it happen. In 2016, the horrible tragedy of Orlando Castile, the young man in St. Paul, Minnesota, who was pulled over because he had a busted brake light, and that ended up in his being shot in the front of his car by the police officer, who was confused about whether or not Philando Castile was reaching for a gun. I don't want these sort of moments to happen so often, and I think the best way to do it is, again, to unbundle the police. Maybe have one force that looks over traffic violations, supplemented, as you say, with technology, speeding cameras, and then maybe reserve a specialist police force to do that which we might still need the police to do, solve violent crimes and keep violent crimes from happening.
Now, police also respond to issues involving drug or alcohol use, homelessness, mental health issues. And that came up in an interview that former vice president and presidential candidate Joe Biden did last week on The Daily Show. He was asked about the idea of having mental health experts, rather than the police, handle an urgent mental illness call. Here's what he said.
My daughter is a social worker. She has her master's in social work. The idea that she's going to respond by herself to a 911 call that says that someone is overdosing or someone has a mental problem and they're acting out, the idea of going by themselves is not rational to expect. Conversely, cops shouldn't go alone. Cops should go with people who are mental health experts.
Derek, what about that argument that in some cases, even if you did unbundle the police, you'd still want a police officer involved in a situation?
I think it's a really, really important point that Joe Biden makes. You know, there are definitely some experiments that different states and cities are doing to essentially unbundle the police and have mental health counselors treat mental health calls, or in Eugene, Oregon, have what's called the CAHOOTS program, which dispatches medics and mental health counselors to homeless people. But there are some times where you are going to need an armed officer. There are 400 million guns in America. You cannot wish them away. You cannot abolish them immediately. And as a result, yeah, of course you're always going to need the presence of armed officers for some of these cases. But I think it's important to point out that for many cases, you won't necessarily need an armed officer. And the very presence of guns can make an otherwise safe situation become suddenly escalated and dangerous. So I'm sensitive, on the one hand, to the research that says that cops can do a lot of good work. But I'm also sensitive to the fact that there's a lot of people who I think are smartly asking to reimagine police work from the bottom up. Ask, where do we need cops to assist social workers, and where do we think the cops are just totally gratuitous? Those are the kind of questions that I think are starting to be asked, and I would like them to be answered under a rubric of not just abolish the police, not just defund the police, but let's think about unbundling the bundle of that which police already do.
Well, and we'll link people to more of your writing about this idea at hereandnow.org. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.